Movies, television, internet, advertising, newspaper, all of those are forms of mass media. Now, what is mass media? That refers to the ways that we communicate messages to large groups of people, large numbers. And the mass media is part of our popular culture. You've probably heard that term. What is culture? Well, it refers to the generally accepted thoughts, beliefs, and actions of a particular group. And the media is certainly part of our culture. You pretty much can't get away from it. It's just everywhere.
Well, the problem with the media is that it deals with two ways of thinking. There's man's way of thinking, which the media presents, and then there's God's way of thinking. And these two ways of thinking are against one another. They're opposed to one another. If you look at Isaiah 55, 8, and 9, you see that in the Bible it talks about how God's thoughts and God's ways are so different from man's ways, that they're as different as the heavens are from the earth. That's how far apart man's ways are from God's ways. And so in the media, we have this man's way of thinking being presented, and it's opposed to God's way. This battle is kind of a cultural battle, and it's a battle for our minds. Who is going to control your mind? And that's a decision that each of us makes as we go and watch TV, as we watch the movies, as we engage with the media. We make this decision whether we do it consciously or unconsciously. So we're going to look at how the media actually impacts our minds, how it impacts our lives, what kinds of messages are being communicated through the media, and what does the Bible say about our response to the media? And we're going to look at each of these things today.
Now, Harold mentioned to you the term mediated reality, and that is something we have to look at first as we begin to talk about all of this. You should have a listening guide in front of you. Use those to fill out blanks and so forth. And we hope that this will really be a help to you. But I'd like for you to keep in mind also that as much or as little as it might help you, think in terms of how you can use this to help others. You guys are in the ministry, going into the ministry. You're probably dealing with others who perhaps don't even know the Lord. So there are things here that will be helpful to understand, number one, and a few ways also that we can perhaps help you utilize what you're learning here and even use a movie-going experience or some other media experience for the benefit of the kingdom. So be thinking in those kinds of terms. That would be really helpful for you. Now, reality. You know, many people look at media, movies, TV, whatever, and they tend to see that as real, that's reality. Well, what if it wasn't really real? Well, then our view of reality becomes somewhat skewed because to the extent that media has altered it, it is skewed. So let's, just for fun, we're using lots of clips and things today and hope you'll enjoy that. But let's look at this first picture. Here's an ad, a billboard. Now, most people would say that she is the epitome, this girl is the epitome of beauty, and she certainly is beautiful. But is she real? Take a look. Isn't that cool? Not real.
I could use some reality like that.
Me too, honey. But I love you anyway, just like you are.
Well,
oh, okay. We didn't mean that to be a mushy moment.
Well, you can see that the final product is based on reality, but it's been skewed. It's been changed. It's not quite what it started out to be. And what we see in the end product is not necessarily real. But not knowing what goes on behind the scenes and all that work that was done to get to the final product, it's really easy to simply assume or to accept that what we see is real, that it's real life, that that's what's really out there. Now, media always communicates something. The way that movies and TV shows do this is really quite powerful. And many times a movie can communicate a message that is accepted, either consciously or unconsciously, while by the average moviegoer, but at the same time, this moviegoer may not really believe the message. But because he's not engaging his brain, he can accept that message subconsciously. Though if you asked him, do you believe this or do you believe that? They'd say, no, I don't believe that. But if you don't engage your brain, the mind will accept messages that the media communicates. Now, one thing that those of us, such as me, who are not technophiles like he is, we don't really know what's going on in the making of a movie. We go and we watch the movie and, you know, maybe we're listening to the dialogue, but we don't know all the technical stuff that's happening. And when John and I go to the movies, you know, I'm the one always listening to the words. I'm listening to the dialogue. I'm analyzing what's being said. And John's looking at something completely different. And I'm more substance. Substance is the content of the movie, the things that are being said. But John, he is style. Can't you just tell?
He is
all style. So why don't you tell us about style?
And that is the next thing on your handout is we're going to talk about for a moment about substance and style. Yes, substance is what's in a movie. It's the actual words used. It's the content. It's what's said. Style is how that substance is presented. It goes more toward a mood or a feel about that particular movie or that piece. Now, the best way I know to explain style to you is to actually show you a movie clip. And I love this clip because it's just a perfect example of style, and it does a couple other things for us. So a few years ago, it was a movie called The Truman Show. Some of you have probably seen that. Truman is played by Jim Carrey, and he is a
character. Who is a character.
Who is a character. The Truman Show, now it's kind of a movie or a show within a movie. The Truman Show is a TV show, it's a reality TV show, when anybody in the world can tune in 24/7 to The Truman Show and watch the story of this life of a young man from boyhood through adolescence and now to adulthood. He has a job and he's married and they get to see what's going on with Truman. What has happened today and how is he going to deal with it? And they can do this at any time. Well, the crazy thing is that everybody knows it's a show and it's a setup for Truman. This is real life. He's just going through life, doing all this. He's married. He's got a wife. But everyone else knows that when he moves from one building to another, he simply moved to another location on the set. When the weather changes, well, that's special effects. Sunrise, sunset, well, somebody pulled a lighting dimmer. And all of his friends and family are actors. Now, remember, he doesn't know this. Now, there's a point in the show where he has begun to suspect something. He thinks, you know, people are starting to kind of trick him. What's going on? This something's not real here. It's not right. Well, obviously, the producers can't let that happen because, well, that would be the end of the Truman Show. You know, the gig is up. So they decide to create this event to take attention away from that. In which they will reunite him with his long-lost father. In this scene, you're going to see that reuniting. It's he and talking to his friend. The first person you'll see is his friend, and of course, Truman is Jim Carrey. Now, as we watch this, pay close attention to how it looks or how it feels. And listen to the words, too. Take a look.
Somewhere else. pointing out of that is that I want to have it for your children.
Now, you see, a filmmaker, if they really know what they're doing, they will take every opportunity they can to use the various tools at their disposal. That includes, you know, close-ups, zooming in, different angles, that sort of thing. There's something very unique in the media that happens. As I stand here in this room, see, this is real life. This is a big room, and I can see all over the room. I can see different people doing things. I can see someone who has to get up and do something, or maybe someone's got a wrist. I can see all of that. At the same time, I can focus in on one person. Don't be nervous. Hi. I can focus in on one person, and I really can focus on him, but at the same time, I still see everything else. Well, what's different about media? Well, there's a camera, and there's a frame, a screen. You know, it's just, it has boundaries. So I can really only see what's inside there. I can only see what's inside there. So if I'm a director, I'm going to put inside that frame what I want you to see. I can make you see what I want you to see. I can make you hear what I want you to hear. I can make you feel what I want you to feel. I can even make you think what I want you to think. That's what directors do. They use this arsenal of a vocabulary of pictures and shots and angles and images. Close-ups, zoom in slow, zoom out, add music, now add special effects, extreme close-ups, all of those kinds of things those are the things that create the style. And interestingly enough, it's the style that sometimes gets the message across, across even better than the words themselves. Now, this clip does another thing, and this is probably perhaps one of the most important things that we're going to tell you about how media works. Did you notice the reaction of the audience and also the crew members in the studio? What was their reaction? Happy, excited. It was very emotional. The primary response to media is emotional. I know you've said this or you've heard, she was so emotional, she just, you know, she didn't know what to do. Or, I was so mad, I just couldn't think straight. You know, it's really true when you're in an emotional state, you tend to get away from the intellectual, the thinking part of yourself. And so, this is what happens. That whole emotional thing is very, very important. It's a little like, what happens is if you see a clip that you really like because of the feel of it, you tend to accept that whole thing, including the content, which you may or may not agree with. It's a little like seeing a beautiful sports car. And it looks great. It's just, it's really beautiful, and that's the style. Now, the substance would be the engine. Does it run in the first place? Is it reliable? But boy, if I want that sports car, it's possible that I can end up with a mechanical lemon. But the style can be so powerful because of this thing with emotion.
Well, we live in a society that places an extremely high value on emotion. Emotion, passion, feeling, following your heart, all these are things that are really expounded in our culture today. Now, earlier this year, John and I went to see a movie, the new Star Trek movie. How many of y'all have seen the Star Trek movie? Oh, a lot of you, yes.
Hey, we're Trekkie fans going way back.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Way back because we're older than all.
Way back. So anyway, back in the some 40 years ago when the first Star Trek came out and you had Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, there was this kind of thing that went on between them. Captain Kirk kind of represented the emotional, passionate, feeling character, whereas Mr. Spock was very logical, very rational, used his mind. Of course, he was part Vulcan, so that helped. And but, you know, he was always kind of the foil, the counterpart to Captain Kirk's just passion that exuded all over everything. So when this movie came out this year, I was excited to go see it. I like Mr. Spock, and I really wanted to watch the movie and see how they portrayed the characters now as young people. And, let's go look at this clip and watch what they did.
I urge you to remain silent. I have only located a suitable planet on which the savage adult can come from. Spock, in this case, do yourself a favor. Put aside a moment. Do a few miles.
Now, you have here the old Mr. Spock who has come back in time to speak to his younger self. And what's the message he gives him? Follow your feelings. Put aside logic. Follow your feelings. Is this what a Vulcan would say? Seriously?
Not even half a Vulcan. No.
So it was, this is the just the thrust of emotion, a feeling of stressing how important it is that you're really a complete person if you can be super passionate, if you can have a lot of feelings. If you're logical, if you're rational, you're not quite there. And this is the thrust of our culture today.
Yeah, so they're even rewriting, you know, characters that have been around a long time. This thing about emotion, your feeling, is really, really key. And it's very deliberate among filmmakers and anybody who masters the media. Let me show you a statement. We're going to walk through this because this is pretty interesting. Here's something that the president of MTV once said. He said, "The strongest appeal you can make is emotionally. If you now get this, if you can get their emotions going, make them forget their logic, you've got them. At MTV, we don't shoot for the 14-year-olds. We own them.
So there's a very intentional effort to get people to live by their emotions, all the way down from the youngest up through teen years and adults. There is an intentional effort to get us to not think logically, to not think rationally, but to live emotionally. Now, how do we receive this mediated reality? How does it actually come and impact our lives? How does it change us? Well, it changes what we know and how we think. It's able to get into our subconscious by constantly bombarding us with information over and over and over again, whether it's in the form of commercials or billboards that you pass on the street or TV shows one after another interspersed with ads for this and ads for that. There's this constant barrage of information coming at us, and it is hard to stop, take a minute, and think about what's being said when 20 seconds later something else is being bombarded at our minds. And so the easy approach is to simply shift our brains into neutral, lean back, and just let it flow. It's easy to do this. It's easy to go into neutral. But C.S. Lewis once said, "The most dangerous ideas in a society are not the ones being argued, but are the ones that are assumed." When we shift into neutral, we allow something else to take control. We assume that's what's being said to us is real, is true, and we don't engage our brains. What we see and hear in the media largely determines what we think about. In fact, what we see and hear in life largely determines what we think about. Our thoughts then go on to influence our feelings and our actions. So the power of the media lies in its ability to influence what we see and hear, and then consequently our thoughts, our feelings, and our behavior after that. So the media is really interested in what you see and hear. They want your attention, because then they can control what you think, whether that's to think about buying a certain product or think about something else. So that's the power of the media.
We talked about style and how weighty that is and how it affects you. Let's talk for a moment about substance, because that is something that we as Christians need to pay attention to. What is the real message and what are the words being said? Carl and I, of course, we love movies. We like to go to the movies and, of course, enjoy them, but we also do this thing that sometimes people say, "Oh, that doesn't sound like fun." We like to go out afterwards and talk about them. We actually talk about, well, what did that movie really say? What was the message? And you know what? We find messages sometimes that really are good and true. And sometimes we find messages that are just obviously wrong and bad. But a lot of times we find messages that sound good. And they feel good, but it's maybe not quite there. And it takes some thinking to get through that. So the way that we think or look at the world is something that comes through movies quite often, and that's called a worldview. The worldview can be compared to wearing glasses. If you have the right prescription, you see the world the way it really is. If you don't have the right prescription, then you see a warped or a twisted view of the world. And likewise, if we do not have a biblical worldview, then our view of reality will not be correct. So there are three primary worldviews that show themselves in the media. We're going to take a look at those right now, the three most common ones.
Okay. The first one we're going to look at is secular humanism. Now, secular humanism is the dominant worldview in the United States today. Even among Christians, it tends to be the dominant worldview. There was a study, a survey done among high school students in Christian schools. And they gave them this questionnaire. This was done across the United States over thousands of students. They gave them a questionnaire that asked basic questions about politics, about religion, about society, just about how life works. And they filled out this questionnaire, and these questions were designed to figure out what their worldview was, these high school students at Christian schools. And the average high school student from a Christian school scored as a secular humanist. So secular humanism, even though you call yourself a Christian or go to a Christian school, secular humanism has worked its way through our culture and into our minds. If we don't actively engage our brain and think through what's being communicated to us, it's easy to do that thing where we shift into neutral and just allow these ideas to affect us and influence us. So what does secular humanism believe? We're going to kind of look at three things on each of these worldviews that we're going to cover. It's the view of God, the view of man, and our view of ethics or morality. The first thing secular humanism believes, and this is all comes from the Humanist Manifesto. It's kind of secular humanists' manual of their statement of beliefs. The first thing they believe is that God does not exist. And in the Humanist Manifesto, too, it says, faith in the prayer-hearing God, assumed to live and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers, and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith. Reasonable minds look to other means for survival. Now, so God's out of the picture right off the bat. Now, if you take God out of the picture, there's got to be somebody who's in charge, somebody who calls the shots, somebody who says what we need to do or not do, and that's man. Man is the measure of all things in a secular humanist worldview. Again, the Humanist Manifesto says, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. People can only look to themselves for answers to life. Now, if man is in charge, man is the epitome of what there is, the highest being on the evolutionary scale, then how do we determine what's right and wrong? God's gone, so that kind of takes the Bible out of the picture, too. So how do we determine what's right and wrong? Well, morality within a secular humanist worldview is determined by two things, reason and experience. Since there's no longer an objective right and wrong, or standard of right and wrong, once man becomes the measure of all things, everything becomes subjective within us. Objective means outside of us. Since there's no longer an objective standard, then we decide what's right and wrong. The right way to act is determined by what makes sense to us. And what, as we work those things out in our lives, what works, what experientially works for us, that becomes what's right and what's wrong. Now, as our culture changes, then right and wrong might change too. We change, culture changes, then we got to kind of shift right and wrong to match, again, what makes sense to us and what works for us in our experience. This is the message that's being predominantly communicated through entertainment, through the media. Most of your superhero movies are all about man saving man. So secular humanism is rampant, and it even reaches down to the little children through television shows. Now, I had a friend a few months ago whose kids, she had some little kids, and they were watching this cartoon on TV. Was reruns of the show Recess. Any of you guys ever watched Recess? Recess fans?
Grew up on Recess.
Okay, so her kids were watching Recess, and she was like in the other room, but she could kind of hear the TV, and something caught her attention. She walked into the room and watched the rest of the show with them, and then told me about it. She repeated later on, and she made a copy, and I got the copy, And we are going to see a couple of clips from this in just a sec, but let me give you the setup of this show. Recess, first of all, for those of you who've never seen it, is an animated show about kids at recess. They go, you know, from their school to recess, and so they play games, they do different things, they have little adventures during recess. And at this particular show, they were playing, I believe it's kickball, and there's an argument about something one of the kids did. Did this follow the rules or was this wrong? And they don't know. They argue about it. So they go to the kid who is the kind of king of the playground and ask him, you know, what's the right thing to do in this situation? So this is where our first clip picks up.
Take a look.
Okay, so what's happened here is there's that discrepancy about the rules. They find this ancient rule book. And because these rules are old, they must be wise. And so they decide they're going to play by King Morty's rule book. And this is what the kids do. They start playing by the rules in this rule book. Well, it doesn't really work out well for them because there's all kinds of strange rules that doesn't really fit with the way that they like to play the game. And yes, King Morty, who made this rule book, was a really wise person, but the rules, we find out, were designed for a different people at a different time for their needs in the past. And the kids today are having difficulty with having fun anymore. It's just not any fun to follow these rules. So they decide they're going to throw out the rule book and just play the game their way. Let's see what happens next. That the ancient book of rules is no longer relevant for our times, and therefore we must come up with new rules that make sense to us, that are built on a foundation of logic. And if those rules stop working, we change them again until they meet our needs and they make sense to us and they fit with our experience. This is a secular humanist message, and you can draw from that, you can infer from this this episode, a lot of things regarding whether it's the Word of God or, you know, if you want to go political and talk about our Constitution. The secular humanist message is that rules that once applied, if they don't make sense, no longer need to be obeyed. We need to invent new rules. So this is secular humanism, basing morality or ethics, how we do things, on both our logic and on reason, rather than on some objective standard of right and wrong outside of ourselves. I showed this clip to I teach a philosophy class to high school students, and I showed actually the whole episode to them, and they'd all watched Recess also, and after it was over, they were like, Mrs. Holliday, you ruined Recess for us! Well, I don't know if I was the one who actually ruined the show for them, but anyway, it's sometimes things appear in shows and we just don't catch them. And kids, little kids who watch these things are obviously not going to be catching the implication, but this influences them as they grow up. And so we need to be aware of what's happening in our society. A second worldview that really permeates the media is cosmic humanism. It's also been called the New Age movement. Now, unlike secular humanism, cosmic humanists do believe in a power greater than ourselves. In fact, that's kind of a misnomer because they would not say it's a power greater than ourselves because the power is us as well. They believe that God, and this is like God with a little g, is an impersonal force that flows through all things. And because we are part of all things, that God is within us too. The gods in the plants, gods in the animals, gods in the chair. God holds it all together, but God is impersonal. It's a force that binds us together and unifies us. Morality, within a cosmic humanist worldview, is determined by listening deeply within yourself to kind of hear what God is saying, listening to that God voice that's within you. The cosmic humanist believes that there are certain things that can help you to hear that voice. You can get in touch with that voice through meditation. You can use crystals. Some cosmic humanists who are really into it channel spirits, because if God is everywhere, then we should be able to contact or make some sort of connection with that force. If it's within us and outside of us, then we just need to connect with that force, and channeling spirits may be the way to do that. They will use statements like, follow your heart. This is not exclusive to a cosmic humanist, but they believe that if you're feeling it, then maybe that's that God voice talking to you and you need to follow your heart. Listen to the child within you. You kind of hear this sometimes on Oprah, if you watch Oprah. And cosmic humanists frequently depict nature or the earth as a living being that speaks to us, because we're connected with everything around us. So the earth itself is a living being, part of that force.
And cosmic humanism has found a voice through the media. You see this impact in the type of this type of message in the popularity of TV shows like Ghost Whisperer and Medium, both shows based on the real life experiences of actual mediums. TV talk shows that often deal with spirituality are usually more this kind of spirituality, more from a cosmic humanist standpoint, as opposed to a biblical standpoint. We're going to take a look at a movie clip from a long time ago. And before you say, oh, man, that is so old, the reason I'm using it is because it's probably the clearest expression of cosmic humanism.
Well, until recently.
And we're going to talk about recently, too. But the movie Star Wars, that whole series, of course, has been around for a long...
We got Star Wars fans out there?
It's been around for a long time, started back about 1977. The second installment, or, you know, that's number two or number five, depending on how you look at it, came out in 1980. That was The Empire Strikes Back. We're going to take a look at a scene there which shows so clearly this cosmic humanist idea. And in this scene, our hero character, Luke Skywalker, is undergoing Jedi training under an unlikely knight, of course, by the name of Yoda. And when this clip begins, Luke has just failed to lift his aircraft out of the swamp by using the Force.
And wouldn't you say that this is the first expression of cosmic humanism in popular culture that we have?
Probably. It certainly gained a lot of popularity.
A lot of popularity.
Starting at that
point, yeah.
Take a look. By the way, did you notice the choice of music there to create a style and a feel and a mood that would be very easy for people to accept? All right, so the Force is everywhere. Energy and how all the things that we seem to that we see seem to be connected in some way. We can draw power from it. He said, luminous beings are we. We're enlightened. And finally, you have to truly connect with this Force if we're going to reach our true potential.
Mm-hmm. So anybody seen a movie recently that sort of communicates this same thing?
Avatar.
Yeah, Avatar. We went and saw Avatar last week, and it very, very clearly communicates a cosmic humanist worldview. The life force is everywhere. It's in everything, the plants, the animals, ourselves. We're all interconnected. In Avatar, the life force is described as a network of energy and the sum total of every living thing, and that our energy is borrowed from this total energy, and at some point we must give it back. This is a cosmic humanist belief. And in fact, the main character, in order to link up with his avatar, he is told that he must relax and let his mind go blank. And this is the method that cosmic humanists, a method cosmic humanists use, a form of meditation in order to make a connection with the life force. So it very much communicates. Wish we could have had a clip, but not legal yet. But someday, been able to show that because it's definitely communicates this worldview. Our third worldview we're going to look at is postmodernism. Now, postmodernism is kind of an offshoot of secular humanism, and it is very hard to nail down because postmodernists don't believe in absolutes. They don't believe you can say anything is anything. You can't, because there are no absolutes. To say something is to make an absolute statement. So to try to describe postmodernism is kind of like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It just doesn't want to stay there. It squishes out in different places, and you just can't quite get a handle on it. But I'm going to try anyway. For the postmodernists, the idea of God is meaningless. If there are no absolutes, God, that word, that whatever that means, it doesn't have a meaning because there are no absolutes. So you can't have God anyway, right off the bat. God's gone. Man himself, since everything is changing, man is many changing, unknowable selves. There is no one you. You don't know who you are. You can't know who you are because you're changing constantly. You can be one way here, one way at school, one way at home, one way in the car. You can be a different person entirely tomorrow. Since it's built on an evolutionary model and since everything is changing, you are constantly changing. So there is no one you. You may be many different selves depending on your environment or who you're around or what your group is. You change constantly. Morality also changes. It changes from person to person, day to day, group to group. There's no nailing down any kind of ethics that applies to everyone because, again, there's no absolutes. Everything is in flux. Everything is changing. There is no one truth with a capital T. There is something that might be true for you and another thing that might be true for you, and those two things could contradict each other. But that's okay. In postmodernism, everything changes, and since you can't nail anything down anyway, it doesn't matter. Contradictions don't matter. It's true for you, and that's what matters, that you know what works for you. Postmodern thinking says things like, that may be true for you, but that's not true for me. You hear people say that. That's a postmodern way of looking at life. Right and wrong are determined by your group, your community. So, you know, here in our little community, we can say we believe this and we're going to live by this standard. And it's because we all agree that we're going to do that. And if people don't agree, they can get out or we just make them obey. But it can change. It changes constantly. So what another group does, another culture, another town, another group, is up to them. They decide. It can be completely different. We cannot pass judgment on anybody else, once again, because there are no absolutes. There's nothing you can point to and say, hey, you're wrong because this says so. No, it's just my opinion versus your opinion, my preference versus your preference. So the community decides, and it can change at any time.
So postmodernism is really hard to nail down. So we're going to take a look at a couple of clips to give you an idea of what this looks like in the movies. Several years ago, there was a family-friendly movie called Secondhand Lions, starring Robert Duvall. And in this movie, as it sounds like many of you know, a 13-year-old boy comes to live with his great uncles. His irresponsible mother drops him off before going on yet another husband-hunting trip. And the two uncles tell the boy wild and fantastic stories about adventures they had in their younger days. Well, the boy finally confronts one of his uncles about these stories. Now, listen carefully to what's being said, but watch this clip.
Those stories about you. than true wrong. The matter. It does too. Around my mom, all I hear is lies. I don't know what to do.
If you want to believe, believe it. Just because something true, that's no reason you can't believe it.
Speech. All right, so here's what happens, and there's all kinds of statements there, and most of them are altogether not even true, but you know, there's all these emotion, here comes emotion again, emotional buzz phrases. True love never dies. All men are basically good, and there are others there. It all sounds good. It must be right. But what we miss are the bookends of that whole statement, where he talks about truth and it doesn't matter. You want to believe in something, just go ahead and believe in it. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. Well, that's postmodernism again, because absolutes are not even a part of it. Now, let's look at another one. That was a family-friendly film. We can also go to a blockbuster movie of recent times to see something of postmodernism also. It's the highest grossing film of last year, well, I guess 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And the second highest of all time, bring in half a billion dollars. The Dark Knight embodies both secular humanism and postmodern themes. Now, we're going to look right at the end of the film. Gotham City has a new district attorney, Harvey Dent, who stands for everything good and just and is determined to rid the city of all evil. However, Dent is pushed over the edge, and he becomes part of the evil that he once vowed to end. Now, after killing several people here at the end of the movie, Police Commissioner Gordon tells Batman that he fears that the people of Gotham will lose hope if they find out their hero, this person who killed all these innocent people, had betrayed them. Now, pay close attention to what's said. Since Batman's a little hard to understand, we've got the words on the screen for you. Take a look.
Thank you.
All right, so listen, you saw the words there that Batman used. Look at all the times that the word need appears. Just think about, you know, what's needed is huge. Gotham needs its true hero. I can be whatever Gotham needs me to be because that's what needs to happen. Truth isn't good enough. Sometimes people deserve more. That's what they need. Sometimes people deserve to have their faith rewarded. So it's all of these, it's almost like believing in the thing that you need, and that's what you should believe in. There's also the idea of community here, because he keeps talking about Gotham. Now, it sounds, for someone who's not a critical thinker, it sounds like, you know, there's something real sacrificial happening here. But again, truth is not a part of the picture.
Yeah, truth isn't important. What's important is, what do people need? They obviously don't need the truth. They need to have their beliefs, whether that's in something false or true. They just need those beliefs confirmed. And truth gets thrown out in favor of the community. What works for us? What do we need? And this is a postmodern idea. Now, I thought Batman was an incredibly great movie to watch. It had a wrong worldview, but it was fascinating to watch. So a lot of these movies that we're talking about are really interesting, they're well written, and that's part of the power that they have in getting their message across, because you get caught up in the action, you get caught up in the special effects, the story carries you along, and little things like, you know, truth just get kind of thrown out, and we don't really pay attention to what's being said in the media.
She has a great review of Dark Knight, by the way, on Facebook. Carl Holiday, Fort Worth. Take some. It's really good.
Thanks, hon. Okay. Okay, so we looked at three worldviews. There are more, but these are the three that really dominate the media within our culture: secular humanism, cosmic humanism, and postmodernism. So what about the biblical worldview? What's that? What is God's way of thinking? We've looked at man's way of thinking, but what about God's way? And we're going to really briefly go over this because we're assuming you already know. And so real quickly, God's way of thinking. We're going to look again at those three areas: the idea of God, man, and ethics. God, according to the Bible, is personal, good, and powerful. We can know him. He's good. He does what is good, and he is powerful. He is able to control what happens. He makes things happen in a good way for us. Second, man. Man has purpose and meaning. We're just not randomly placed here. According to the Bible, we have a purpose. God has given us a purpose. He tells us he has a plan for our lives, a purpose, and that this purpose was worked out long before we ever came into being. So we have a purpose that we can only be fulfilled in fulfilling. Third, morality. What we do, what's right and wrong. Morality is living life according to God's word. That's his rule book. And with him being in charge, we can only find success in life if we follow his rules. C.S. Lewis had this incredible quote, said this incredible statement: I wouldn't have known what crooked was unless I knew what straight was. And this is what the biblical worldview communicates. God is our straight. He is our plumb line. He is our absolute by which everything else is measured and by which we know the truth. We can know God through his word and know what he has for us.
So, those are the three big worldviews that we see in media. Let's talk now for just a little bit before we close about how do we engage our culture. Remember, we're living in the midst of a cultural battle, and this battle is for our minds. We can choose to either follow man's way or God's way. You know, we do see in Scripture, there are instances of key people who engage the culture. Tell us the story of Paul near Athens.
Yeah, one thing that's easy to think about is, you know, if culture's all this bad stuff, if there's all this media out there that's communicating all this bad stuff, maybe I'll just, like, not ever watch TV again, or I'm not going to go to the movies. And, you know, that is an option that's available to us. But one thing that's really encouraging to me is to look at what Paul did when he encountered the culture of people. And there's this great story in Acts where Paul is, you know, on one of his missionary journeys, and he's traveled to Greece to the city of Athens. And if you know anything about Athens, you know it was the big cultural center of the world at that time. And when Paul gets there, he's going to go communicate the gospel, but before he goes to preach to the people or to teach them, he walks around the city. And he sees their idols, and he sees the inscriptions that are written beneath them. And he thinks about the lifestyle of the Athenians. And he comes to this one idol that is to an unknown god. And Paul, then when he goes to talk to the Athenians later, is able to take this piece of their culture, which he studied and he looked at and he thought about, and able to apply it to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so he bridges the gap between things that are obviously wrong in the Athenian culture to what's right and true and good. And he makes that connection with the people through their culture. And this is something that we can do as Christians. We can engage the culture and find a bridge through what's communicated in the movies, TV, through the media, to relate to those non-believers around us and communicate the truth of the gospel as well.
And for ourselves and for other people, the good news is there are certain steps that you can take also to counteract the impact, especially the negative impact of the media on our thoughts. And here's just a few of them.
Okay, first thing is be on guard. Colossians 2:8 says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ." Those who create mediated entertainment in our culture have largely dismissed God and the Bible from it. Now, there are a few people who are working in that area. But largely, you, when you go to the movies or you watch a program, you need to expect that the media is sending you a wrong message. So be on guard, be watchful, engage your mind.
A second one is, do not conform to the way the world thinks, but renew your minds. Romans 12:2, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. What we're saying here is engage your brain. Listen to what's being said. I hear people say sometimes that, you know, I really don't want to think, I just want to enjoy. But the fastest way to conformity is to sit back and let others do your thinking for you.
The third thing is to examine what you hear. In 1 John 4:1, it says, "My dear friends, don't believe everything you hear. Carefully weigh and examine what people tell you." So it's not simply enough to listen. You've really got to evaluate and ask the question, is this true? Is what's being communicated right here, is this a true statement? And how do you know what the truth is? Well, you have to know your Bible. In Acts 17:11, Paul is again on a missionary journey. He's been to visit the Thessalonians, and now he's in this new place called Berea. And he's talking to the Bereans. It's a city north of Greece. And listen to what is said of these people in Acts 17:11. "Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true." The Bereans compared what Paul said to the scriptures, and they're called people of noble character. We need to compare what we receive from the media to the scriptures as well, to evaluate it. See, is it true? Does it align with God's word?
All right, here's another one. Reject wrong thinking. 2 Corinthians 10:5. "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." Now, listen to those words there. Those are some pretty heavy words. We demolish arguments and we take captive every thought. This is a great word picture. What we're saying is that if it's wrong, first of all, just identify it as such and reject it. But those words are so strong, it really is warfare. Demolish and catch that. It's like catch that thought and just make it obey. That's kind of what we're talking about here. Make it obey Christ. Don't stop at just saying what's wrong. Go ahead and say what would make it right and what is right.
Replace the wrong thinking with right thinking. And finally, focus on right thinking. Philippians 4:8. And now, dear brothers and sisters, one final thing. Fix your thoughts on what is true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise. When you go to the movies, if there's something good or right in the movie, you know, think about it. Focus on that. Usually there's something. It's usually not 100% bad. Usually there's some sort of good that can be taken away. Look for things that reflect God's image. Even if the filmmaker or the musician, in case of songs, didn't intend it. We're still created in the image of God, and even though that image is warped and broken, there are things that we can pull away from people that are good and reflect the image of God. So look for those things. Focus on right thinking.
Guys, we hope that's been a help to you. Thank you so much. Appreciate letting us be here. We're going to bring...
Harold's coming up.
Harold's going to come and join us, and we'll take a few questions. And let me just mention, we've done this in different versions at different times. Sometimes it's more of a smaller workshop for several hours. I do have just so you know, I do have a resource CD here at the table at the back, which has some of this same information, but it also has a few things that we didn't talk about. For example, there's a formula. It's just questions to ask when you're at a movie to try to determine the main message. And then some of these other things we talked about go into more depth. But there's some MP3 audio files, some PowerPoint, so forth with it. Normally it's about $18, but if you're in this room, conference special, $10. We've got a few back there if you're interested. Just wanted to mention that.
I don't know what time it is.
But now we can go with... time? I hope not. I turned my phone on.
Who's got the time?
I think we're okay, though.
3:23.
We got
more.
Oh,
we got 2 hours.
Yeah.
Art forms are a lot of fun, whether it's music or movies. But as time goes on, and more of the story of Douglas Armbuster really did come a very good value. You must learn to use your brain. Pick out what's good. Throw away what's evil, that's what Paul says. But that doesn't have to be in your brain. Hey, you're intelligent, well, I think you're intelligent. As you go to the movie and enjoy the movie, don't get stuck. That leads you to trouble. You know it's going to lead you to trouble. Don't worry. But as you go to the dark night, you sort of watch it. You get a feeling something's not right, something's not good, and you go, wow, that was unbelievable. Say you're sure. As you practice, you'll get more and more and more ability to do this. We want to teach our kids how to do this as they're growing up. But my daughter, when she was about 2 and a half, she talked very early. We said that once, that's been scripted. First time she saw some baby. And on Sesame Street, we took the count. You know the count? Yeah, he teaches you how to count. Pretty dark. And he started to do his thing, and she's kind of on the Sesame Street so far. And she looks at me, she says, Daddy, that's a fucking, she says, he's a bad puppet. Her level of discernment at that point was not really that much, but she didn't see that much.
Yeah.
As time went on, they learned to think more complicated and then more complex fashion. So you learn how to evaluate. Michael Medved, he's a Jewish believer, he's a very, very sharp guy. Now read some of his stuff. Check out some of his stuff they did. I think what we'll do is go ahead and discuss this. Are we Kelsey?
I think we're okay really on time. Why don't we take three or four at least if there are some. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I have to admit I've only seen the first one. I haven't seen the second. And again, what we need to do as far as watching movies is to look at what the message is that's being communicated and compare it to Scripture. I don't want to make a blanket statement about if a movie has this in it. Well, I could make a blanket statement, but I'm not going to, that you can never go see it. It's the message that's being communicated about what's good, what's right, what's true, what's real, that we need to analyze and find out, does this match up to what Scripture says or does it not?
Yeah, and one of the things that you can put the bind on, in quite a few movies, Thelma and Louise, a bunch of others, is whenever the bad guy becomes the hero, that leads you into tremendous emotional conflict. You sympathize with the bad guy, your heart goes out to the bad guy, you just hate it when they blow him apart. Oh, so bad. But he was so bad. But he was such a nice guy. But he was so bad. You got this conflict on this side, and it leads you to trouble. Enough of it starts to erode your sense of pride. So you need to be very sharp about this. When the dark images are the good guy. So, I don't know if that part's ever got to say that. I haven't seen that movie yet.
There's a sense, too, where, you make good choices as far as seeing it or not, and we're not going to tell you yes or no, because it's a very complicated thing. But I think what we're trying to say is, as much as you make those choices, you're going to encounter things sometimes that may disturb you or at least have a message that doesn't, go with what you believe. And so the idea of engaging your brain and continue to think about everything that you receive would be a big help.
Francis Schaeffer years ago wrote a book called Art and the Bible. I suggest you read it, Art and the Bible. It's all one. He says that it's not impossible that an artwork could really be superior, but its message is totally wrong. It's also entirely possible that an artwork could be completely true and really shoddy.
Yeah.
So as you start evaluating those movies, you do the whatever. Technique may be great, the composition may be great, the message may be wrong. So you look at the art and the body, that's it. Another question, yes, sir?
So you guys were talking about if Christian schools and students kind of are conforming to that worldview, do you think it's possible that Christian literature is starting to push some of these worldviews that's seeping into things that we go and get at, like,
a
family Christian bookstore and stuff?
My question, if Christian schools are turning out kids who have a sexually transgender people, is that possibly also seeking into Christian media, Christian books? Can you run with this through Christian forms, Christian books, Christian movies?
Do you want to go, or I'll go?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what I was going to say.
The thing to remember is that being a Christian doesn't inoculate you against all wrong thinking. And yes, I'm not being an expert on every Christian book out there. All I can tell you is that I have read some that definitely do not communicate a Christian worldview. So yeah, you have to be careful. Even if it's written by a Christian, sung by a Christian, made by a Christian, it doesn't necessarily compute that it's going to have a biblical worldview.
And some have become very popular and have great readership, but if you really look at it closely, there's good things in it, and there's not so good things in it. Sometimes that happens.
You guys back at this is horrible because we're doing the what tips do you have for aspiring filmmakers? Those that don't call in and see some make their films. I don't make films. I do write books. And kids haven't seen action adventures for high school. Just a comment, or just right off. If you are going to do media, for the sports or whatever, you want to do it well.
Yeah.
It must be good. You guys tell us more.
My first thing for you would be, may you change the world as you do that. Hollywood needs our influence. There is a way, though, as you make films, to build into it a message which is true and good and right along biblical guidelines. There's a little bit of a science to that. In fact, we talk about that a little bit on the CD there. But that is certainly something that you want to strive to do. Understand the mechanics of that message and how it gets communicated. And once you do that, it's sort of in reverse. You should be able to craft a story which communicates really high moral values and great stories. And again, as Harold said, make sure you strive for excellence on the technical side. As far as the business of it, it's tough. We're seeing more and more Christians in the industry, and you don't hear about them very often. But they, some of them are really coming along. So, getting into it in a serious way, you'll probably have to endure some sacrifice and hardship along the way just to kind of get going in it. But there's always those breaks that you hope for, where you do an independent film and it wins an award at a festival and you can, then suddenly you've kind of made a name for yourself and you're in. But that's rare. It's going to take a lot of hard work and effort, generally speaking.
I would just add to that, just know what you believe. So many Christians just don't know what they believe. Know your Bible. Know what the truth is. And as that transforms your life, that will come out in your writing. Now, in the writing, you have to do it with excellence, as Harold was saying. But I know that there's a market for scripts in Hollywood. And I think a lot of the problem is not that... I think it's just that people are unwilling to take the step to go ahead and write and take the time and effort to do it and try. And it may mean failing over and over again, but going ahead and trying until, you possibly succeed. But know what you believe. Yeah.
There's a book called The Universe Next Door. World news, if you've not read it. Yeah, they're college students. The Universe Next Door, but inside of us, I don't know. I think they're very good position. Because it's got that one. He goes through the different philosophical views with the West and compares it to the theism. It's a great helpful tool for clarifying that position. I talked to a guy. I was in his office in Beverly Hills, while I was working on his books, and I had a friend who knew him. He offered some advice, so I would drop by to see him. I held his two postures, one at a time. I think they're filled with mercury or something like that. But anyway, very successful man. He says, he's a Christian, so one of the problems is they want to write stories about nice people getting nice things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real world is something like that.
Yeah.
So, do some checking, do some thinking. Another question.
Right here?
Right here, yes.
Hi. Earlier you were talking about the style of your movies, and as another Christian artist, I was wondering what you think about Christian artists manipulating the emotions of their audience, like they do in the secular films. Is that cool, not cool, something to be very careful with? It seems like a lot of power.
Yeah, by virtue of the fact you set out to do something with visual art or even music, you've already decided to impact emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Questions to just see what you do.
Yeah, I do it. You bet. I evoke emotion as much as possible. In fact, media like film and TV, any kind of moving visual like that, is most effective in the realm of motivating somebody to do something. In order to do that, that's going to involve evoking emotion and bringing them to some point where they change their mind about something or they decide they're going to, decide on a particular behavior or action. Those things do it well, and if you craft it correctly, it will. It's a free world. There are others out there who are doing the same thing, but their message is bad. and I'm going to do my with my message good. And there's sure, you, it, again, just like you said, it's built in. You should do it, or it would not be excellent.
There is nothing wrong with evoking emotion. There is nothing
or manipulating emotion. Or, yeah.
Yeah. What we want though is people who don't live by emotion, who live by what's right and true, and engage their brain.
Yeah, the Aristotle, he thought music was pretty dangerous because music had the power to move you without you thinking. And Goebbels, German propagandist, he used that as a good song about that all the time. Because of the dominant thing. But be authentically, be right, be good. I am helped when my emotions are called out of the right thing. One more. Yes, sir. Well, I think I've been running to church. I haven't seen that movie.
I've noticed that there's been a lot of success. I've heard a lot about like the movie Fireproof and that church. And it seems like there's an organization. Do you have any comment on their success or what they've been able to do or anything like that?
Well, I think it's great that they've made an effort and they've actually reached people with their message. Is their standard of movie making up to the same level as a lot of the secular media? Not yet, but hey, something's better than nothing, and they're a long way from nothing. So I really applaud their efforts to go ahead and enter a field that's very difficult for Christians to enter into.
One of the great things about the internet and software today is neither are the news media totally charged now. Nor is Hollywood. Things are breaking down. I think that office got to control a lot of office stuff. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you.